If you really want to understand a planet, geologists say you have to take a core sample.
Right, yeah.
You drill down and pull it up.
Exactly. You drill down, pull up the single cylinder of rock, and that one cross-section tells you basically everything. I mean, the pressure, the climate, the absolute extremes of that exact moment in time.
It's a snapshot.
Yeah, snapshot. And welcome to the deep dive, by the way, because today, for you, the listener, we actually have our own kind of core sample.
We do. We've got a massive stack of the major U.S. newspapers.
Yeah, and they're all from exactly Friday, June 12, 2026. Mm. We were talking The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, USA Today, The Los Angeles Times, The Washington Post.
And what's wild is what you see when you overlap them all.
Right. Isn't just the daily news.
No, it's a global system stretched so tight it feels like it's about to snap. I mean, we're looking at the greatest accumulation of wealth in human history happening at the exact same second as total just international gridlock.
Okay, let's unpack this, because I know the mission of our deep dive today is to really synthesize this world of absolute extremes.
Yeah, it's a cross-section of a world operating at maximum tension.
And figure out how everyday people are navigating the fallout, right?
Exactly. When you take all these front pages together, the three line is just undeniable. You have these massive, unpredictable, macro-level forces, billionaires, global conflicts, collapsing institutions, forcing everyday people into intense, highly localized modes of survival.
Because the macro world is just out of control.
Right. So humans are fiercely optimizing their micro lives.
Well, let's start with the biggest macro force on the board today, which is just the sheer velocity of capital. The Journal and the Post are both cracking the largest initial public offering in history today.
Oh, the SpaceX IPO.
Yes, SpaceX is going public. It's a $75 billion IPO, pricing at $135 per share.
Which is astronomical.
It is. Mm. And to put that demand in perspective, BlackRock alone put in an order for $5 billion worth of shares before the opening bell even rang.
The scale of that liquidity is just, it's really hard to wrap your head around. But the headline that's dominating the coverage is what this IPO actually does to Elon Musk's net worth.
Right. The new milestone.
Yeah. Between his holdings in Tesla and his roughly 50% stake in SpaceX, this public offering officially pushes him over the line. He is, on paper, the first trillionaire.
Oh, man. I was reading the fine print on that valuation and the sources, and the mechanics of how he actually gets that money are wild.
And a milestone shares, right?
Yeah. That wealth depends on, quote unquote, milestone shares. These aren't standard stock options that just vest after you stick around for 4 years.
No, they're not.
They are tied to literal sci-fi objectives, like deploying massive data centers into orbit and establishing a functioning human settlement on Mars.
It's like unlocking video game achievements for real-world wealth.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah.
And I have to push back a bit on the underlying economics here. Mm. I mean, is there actual tangible value being traded? Or is the market just pricing in a sci-fi novel?
Well, that's the thing.
Because how does a Wall Street analyst even build a discounted cash flow model for a Martian colony?
They don't. I mean, you can't model the revenue of a non-existent interplanetary economy.
So what are they buying?
What the market is pricing in is faith. And what's incredibly revealing about the structure of modern wealth is who else gets to monetize that faith.
Who do you mean?
Well, the secondary winner in this IPO isn't some massive institutional hedge fund. It's a single individual named Antonio Gracias of Valor Equity Partners.
Oh, right. The early backer.
Exactly. He backed Musk during the most volatile early days of Tesla, back when bankruptcy was a very real threat. And through that enduring loyalty, his firm secured a 6.7% stake in SpaceX.
Wait, 6.7% of a $75 billion valuation? That payout has to be larger than the GDP of a small country.
It translates to a $68 billion payday.
Wow. Just for being early and not selling.
Right. That is the ultimate capitalist dream realized in a single morning. But to understand the true extremes of this specific day in 2026, you really have to look at the exact opposite end of the economic spectrum.
The other side of the coin.
Yeah, because while billions are flowing into the vacuum of space, the great capitalist cure for global poverty has officially flatlined down here on Earth.
Ah, you're talking about microfinance.
Yes, microfinance.
I mean, Muhammad Yunus pioneered this, won the Nobel Peace Prize for it back in 2006, and I remember the absolute euphoria around the concept.
Oh, everyone loved it.
The pitch was so elegant, right? You give a tiny loan to a desperately poor person in a developing nation, they use it to buy a sewing machine or some livestock.
Set up a small business.
Right. They build a micro business and they pull themselves out of poverty. It was supposed to be the silver bullet.
The optimism was pervasive, but the new academic data published today paints a very, very different reality.
What's it saying?
Well, rigorous randomized controlled trials have now conclusively shown that microfinance has completely failed to dent global poverty.
Wow. So what went wrong?
The underlying mechanism broke down entirely. Instead of using the loans as capital investment, like buying that sewing machine to generate new income,
yeah,
desperate populations used the money for basic human consumption.
Wait, so like paying for emergency medical expenses or just food?
Exactly. They used it for basic survival.
Oh, man. So they are taking on high interest debt just to eat, which means there is zero return on investment to actually pay the loan back.
That is the exact trap. And because the loans aren't generating revenue, the debt just compounds. We're seeing catastrophic repayment crises from Cambodia to Bosnia.
It's failing globally.
Everywhere. In parts of Latin America, the interest rates have topped 100%.
100%.
Yeah. And the aggressive collection tactics by these loan officers have triggered a sociological nightmare. The sources detail a surge in homelessness, an epidemic of suicides tied directly to the shame of default.
That is devastating.
And children being pulled out of school to work in hard labor just to service the family's micro debt.
It's just devastating. I mean, you have this corporate boardroom mantra of doing good while doing well, which looks mathematically flawless in a slide deck.
Right.
But when you deploy it into the messy, desperate reality of human survival, it almost becomes a weapon. It's a brutal reminder of the limits of trying to solve deeply ingrained societal issues with financial engineering.
Absolutely. And that friction between pristine theory and chaotic reality is everywhere in today's papers. I mean, it's not just failing in global finance. It is actively fracturing global diplomacy right now.
Okay, before we dive into the fallout in Washington and the Middle East, I want to pause and make something totally clear to you, the listener.
Yeah, this is a critical point.
We're not here to pick political sides, validate any party, or spin a narrative. Our only goal today is to look at the raw facts of this geopolitical chess match exactly as the global intelligence community and the journalists on the ground reported them.
And that context is vital because the facts reported on June 12th show a geopolitical landscape operating purely on whiplash.
Dizzying is the only word for it.
The timeline regarding the conflict with Iran over the last 24 hours is almost impossible to track.
Yeah, let's look at the timeline. So President Trump started Thursday by threatening to launch a third consecutive night of bombing campaigns against Iran, specifically targeting Karg Island.
Right.
And for context, Karg Island isn't just a military base. It handles roughly 90% of Iran's crude oil exports. Bombing it would effectively shatter their economy and send shockwaves through the global energy grid.
It would be massive.
But then, just hours after making the threat, he abruptly reversed course. He called off the strikes, announced a peace deal had been brokered via Pakistani mediators.
Right, and the rationale presented by the administration is that the initial strikes successfully dismantled Iran's top-tier leadership. So the claim is that a smarter, second-tier leadership stepped in and agreed to massive concessions, ending the war, dismantling their nuclear program, and reopening the Strait of Hormuz.
And in return?
In return, the U.S. would lift its naval blockade and unfreeze tens of billions in sanctions.
But, like, the ink wasn't even dry on those headlines before Esmail Bakai, the spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry, went on state television and flatly denied that any final agreement had been reached.
Yeah, he called the claims entirely speculative.
So is this a calculated, asymmetric diplomatic strategy on both sides? Or is it just raw chaos? Because it feels like sitting at a high-stakes poker game where the dealer keeps changing the rules, the stakes, and the cards right in the middle of a hand.
I mean, that's a perfect analogy.
How do global markets even begin to price in that kind of unpredictability?
They don't. They just grind to a halt. The World Bank actually issued a stark warning in today's papers precisely because of this dynamic.
What did they say?
They reported that this specific conflict, combined with the resulting spike in energy prices, is slowing global economic growth to its absolute weakest pace since the pandemic.
Wow.
The macro level unpredictability acts as a massive tax on the entire global engine. And what we are seeing today is that this international tension doesn't just stay neatly contained overseas.
No, definitely not.
It immediately paralyzes domestic institutions.
Yeah. The ripple effect hits Washington instantly. Right in the middle of this massive international crisis, there is an absolute meltdown within U.S. intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Outgoing Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard is stepping down.
Right.
And to fill the vacuum, President Trump attempted to appoint Bill Polt as the acting director.
And Polt is the director of a federal mortgage regulation agency. He has zero formal background in the intelligence community or national security.
So putting a mortgage regulator in charge of the nation's spy apparatus during an active conflict,
mm-hmm.
that sparked an incredible bipartisan revolt.
Oh, completely.
And the way Congress fought back is just fascinating. The House of Representatives essentially weaponized a massive piece of national security legislation just to protest the personnel choice. They rejected a critical extension of FISA Section 702.
And the gravity of that cannot be overstated. FISA Section 702 is the cornerstone post 9/11 surveillance tool.
Right.
It is the legal framework that allows the government to compel U.S. tech companies to hand over the communications of foreign targets overseas. Letting it lapse effectively blinds the intelligence community.
Nearly all Democrats and 19 Republicans voted against the extension, practically ensuring the tool dies.
Yeah, they were willing to shut down the government's ability to intercept foreign communications just to force the president's hand.
And it worked. He pivoted and announced he would nominate former SEC Chair Jay Clayton for the DNI role, which immediately calmed the Senate leadership.
That legislative hostage-taking really shows how deeply fractured the system is. And it's happening alongside another deeply unusual political maneuver detailed in the sources today.
The impeachment void.
Yes. The president is aggressively pushing lawmakers to pass a resolution to void his first-term impeachments. Now, constitutional scholars note there is no legal mechanism to simply erase an impeachment from the historical record.
Right. It's not a legal reality.
Exactly. But the push isn't about legal reality. It's a forcing function. It demands that Congress spend its limited bandwidth relitigating the past right before an election, rather than addressing the immediate crises.
When you lay it all out like that, the global economy slowing down, the threat of expanding war, the weaponization of intelligence laws, the political paralysis, it is just a suffocating amount of sustained pressure on the public.
It is. And sociology tells us that when a society is under that much systemic weight, it desperately seeks an outlet.
Yeah.
It requires a distraction that offers clear rules, binary outcomes, and immense scale.
That perfectly explains the era of mega spectacles we're living in right now. I mean, when the real world is too muddy and complex, we turn to the surreal. And today is serving up some absolute fever dreams in the papers.
No, without a doubt.
First off, the 2026 World Cup just kicked off at the Estadio Azteca in Mexico City. It's the most ambitious tournament in history. 48 teams, 104 matches spread across the U.S., Mexico, and Canada.
Yet even a spectacle of that magnitude can't escape the geopolitical gravity.
How so?
The Los Angeles Times coverage highlights the severe political angst overshadowing the matches. The logistics are literally buckling under the weight of strained international relations, tariffs, and travel bans that are actively preventing fans from entering the U.S. host cities.
Wow. And if the World Cup is buckling under the pressure, Washington, D.C. is just leaning all the way into the absurdity of the moment. The UFC is hosting the Freedom 250 today.
This is wild.
It's a $60 million cage match taking place on the South Lawn of the White House. It's designed to celebrate the president's 80th birthday and the nation's 250th anniversary.
It's unprecedented.
Hosting a brutal mixed martial arts fight on the White House lawn feels like mixing a formal state dinner with a bar brawl.
It absolutely shatters every historical precedent for the space. But it also codifies a decades-long alliance between Dana White and Donald Trump, going way back to when Trump gave MMA a mainstream venue while it was still banned in 36 states.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. What's fascinating here is how these athletic spectacles operate as a societal pressure release valve. We project our deep anxieties onto these fighters. We want them to overcome impossible odds because our own institutions seem incapable of doing so.
Right. But the sources reveal that even our gladiators are compromised. The New York Times dropped a massive investigation today into UFC star Conor McGregor.
Yeah, this was huge news.
He is making this highly anticipated return to the octagon after snapping his leg in half 5 years ago. It was supposed to be this miraculous comeback story, but the Times investigation alleges he utilized banned performance-enhancing drugs to accelerate the healing of that gruesome injury.
And the details of how the testing protocols were circumvented are striking, because this wasn't a back alley transaction. He was allegedly aided by Dr. Neil Eletrak,
the famous sports doctor.
Yes, the highly respected sports physician for the Los Angeles Dodgers and Rams. They exploited testing loopholes, ghosting whereabouts, and evading anti-doping officials to facilitate the recovery.
Wow.
It forces a mirror onto the audience. Like, we demand superhuman feats and miraculous recoveries from our entertainers, but we feign shock when they employ illicit, extraordinary means to deliver them.
That is so true. But then, sometimes the spectacle just delivers pure, unadulterated magic without the asterisk. Like the New York Knicks.
Oh, that game.
Game four of the NBA Finals against the Spurs, the Knicks were down by 29 points. The mathematical probability of winning from that deficit is microscopic. And they pulled off the biggest comeback in NBA Finals history to win 107 to 106.
Just unbelievable.
The descriptions of Manhattan are incredible. Spike Lee dancing on the court, Taylor Swift waving a towel, people standing on top of food carts in the streets, just pure delirium.
It is a textbook example of collective effervescence. For that one night, the global economy, the collapsing microfinance markets, and the geopolitical chessboard simply ceased to matter to millions of people. It's a temporary reprieve.
So what does this all mean? Which brings us to the ultimate question for you, the listener, and for us. How do we actually live in this environment? We've talked about trillionaires, failed poverty cures, global brinkmanship, and White House cage matches. The through line is that the macro institutions are failing to protect the individual. So everyday people are developing what sociologists might call micro-sovereignty. If the world is chaotic, you fiercely optimize the few things you can actually control.
Exactly. That transition from macro reliance to micro adaptation is everywhere in the lifestyle sections today. Look at the housing market. Furnished short-term rentals in Manhattan are easily hitting $5,000 a month.
The system is just broken.
It is. So you have people like Katie Redig, a young professional who moved to the city with two suitcases, bypassing the traditional market entirely.
But what did she do?
She moved into a convent in Chelsea with a group of nuns.
You're kidding.
No. She trades an 11 p.m. curfew and quiet hours for highly affordable rent and a hot dinner.
Oh, wow. That is brilliant. The psychological comfort of having agency over your life is becoming more valuable than traditional luxury.
Definitely.
Or look at Providence, Rhode Island. You have a 27-year-old named David Morales running for mayor on a single, laser-focused generational issue: housing affordability and rent caps. His entire political platform is just, let's build a city where you don't find yourself priced out of your own neighborhood when it's time to renew your lease.
Yeah, and we see that same hyperlocal adaptation with food costs too. Inflation has decimated traditional grocery budgets, so consumers like 25-year-old Matthew Hall in North Carolina are just abandoning the supermarket.
What are they doing instead?
They're utilizing apps like Too Good To Go, purchasing surplus, highly discounted, quote unquote, surprise bags of food from local restaurants at closing time.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Yeah, it combats food waste, sure, but primarily it is a micro hack to survive macroeconomic inflation.
And that feeling of helplessness isn't just about rent or grocery bills, it is environmental. The National Weather Service just announced a 63% chance of a very strong El Niño developing, bringing extreme weather and heavy rains.
Right.
With the climate looming, there's a collective anxiety that the outside world is fundamentally hostile. So where do people retreat? They retreat to the one thing they still have absolute sovereignty over, their own bodies.
That absolutely explains the explosion of interest in hyperpreventative biology we are seeing today. The Washington Post features Yale neuroscientist Mia Kivipelto, who details how the habits we form in our 40s, 50s, and 60s are the ultimate critical window to prevent dementia.
The ultimate window,
Yeah,
right?
because the biological degradation begins 15 to 20 years before the first symptoms ever show. You cannot control international diplomacy or the price of rent, but you can control your sleep hygiene, your cardiovascular output, and your neurological health.
Wow. So let's look back at this core sample we took of June 12, 2026. We started at the absolute zenith of wealth, with SpaceX's $75 billion valuation and the dream of colonizing Mars.
A literal moonshot.
Right. And then we waded through the collapse of microfinance, the brinkmanship of global war, the weaponization of spy tools, and the surreal spectacle of an octagon on the White House lawn. And we ended up in a convent in Manhattan where someone is just trying to make rent. And in our own biology, trying to stave off cognitive decline.
It is a profound spectrum of human experience. But as we finish this deep dive, I actually want to leave you with one final thought from these sources.
Oh, what?
It's something that completely challenges our basic assumptions about how we fix broken systems.
Okay, let's hear it.
We have spent decades believing that when we identify a severe systemic societal flaw, the ultimate mechanism for justice is financial restitution.
Yeah, payout settlements.
Exactly. But what if our fixes are just creating new, more sophisticated disasters? Look at Los Angeles County today. They established a massive $4 billion settlement fund to right the horrific historical wrongs of sexual abuse in their juvenile halls. It was designed to be a model of restorative justice.
Well, on paper, that is the exact right thing to do.
Right. But today, the LA County District Attorney, Nathan Hochman, is urgently asking a judge to halt all payouts.
Great. Why?
The reason is staggering. He believes that 4 out of 5 of those claims, so 80% of the total filings, might be completely fraudulent.
Wait, 80%? How is that even possible?
Well, the investigation alleges this is being driven by organized recruiters. They are literally paying off individuals who are never even in county custody to file false claims against the fund.
Oh my God.
It forces us to ask a deeply uncomfortable philosophical question. In our desperate, well-intentioned rush to correct the injustices of the past, are we accidentally building the fraud machines of the future?
Wow. That completely flips the script. It's exactly like that core sample we talked about at the beginning. You drill down, expecting to hit solid bedrock, the foundation of justice, and you pulled up only to realize the ground beneath your feet is hollow.
It is. It really is a lot to process.
It is a lot to process, but that is exactly why we do this. So take that thought and all the micro-sovereignty hacks we discussed into your weekend. Keep questioning the mechanisms behind the headlines, and thank you for taking the deep dive with us today.